Thank you so much for your time, Professor. And I just want to just get this question right off the bat. Reading some of your works, and particularly Why Nations Fail and The Narrow Corridor, which I really liked, I've always had a lingering question as to what explains the explainer, and what explains the variations in political institutions that you speak of? Because I think you often use as a very, very powerful explanatory variable, but I was just wondering if you've been looking into what underpins the variations or what causes the variations in institutions in that sense.
Well, I mean, I think if you sort of push that reasoning too far, meaning that you need a deterministic cause of everything, you know, ultimately that gets you into a quagmire. You know, nothing other than geography is sort of predetermined. So ultimately, you know, where do institutions come from? Well, I don't think it's geography, but it's those interactions between various human behaviors together with the environment. So let me give you a specific example, which we touch upon in Why Nations Fail briefly. It's the question of why did the Neolithic Revolution happen in some places and not others? And the most dominant view in that respect is not completely non-institutional. A lot of people recognize that the Neolithic Revolution wasn't just a sort of a food production revolution. It was, to a large extent, an institutional revolution. It completely transformed the way that humans live. Their societies are organized, the power relations, their economic institutions, and everything. But, you know, if you ask most scholars on this topic, they fall back onto a geographic explanation. You know, the areas which, you know, Ian Morris calls the lucky latitudes, or the what Jared Diamond emphasizes as the places, you know, blessed with domesticable species.
Yeah.
You know, those were the places where, you know, you could have those sorts of transitions to agriculture. You know, that's certainly right that there were, you know, these were important preconditions.
Yeah.
It would have been much harder to have the transition to agriculture in Alaska or in Antarctica.
Mm.
But, you know, what they ignore is that there are, you know, hundreds of places where those preconditions are met. So what distinguished some from others? And what explains the fact that in a few of them, you had the first flourishings of agriculture, and then a few more complex civilizations emerge, but in 100 years, they collapse. So in others, you form more durable ones. And I think at the end of the day, the most coherent explanation for it is that it's only in some places that the right visions formed. So people understood how they could organize society, and they formed the right coalitions to make that happen, and they were lucky enough not to be forced, well, not to be faced with an insurmountable opposition. So of two neighboring places, one of them made the transition, completely reorganized life, and the other one didn't. So I think that is the general template for thinking about institutions, you know, meaning that this human element is really critical. In some places, you're going to have the right social conditions, the right coalitions, the right lack of opposition, the right compromises, and also the right vision to make that happen. And I see that as ultimately quite uplifting, because if everything was biologically or geographically predetermined, you know, not only would social science be boring, but also our lives would be sort of quite dull.
Absolutely. And I actually wanted to follow up on that, because I think one of these sort of suggestions I have might be that if we're looking at what predates the establishment of the first institutions, maybe we're looking more at things like the cultural or the cultural dimension of how the first societies were organized and how they then subsequently evolved. And I think one of the criticisms that might have been directed towards your work is perhaps the seeming emphasis upon institutions, almost to some extent at the expense or exclusion of the harder to operationalize dimensions of culture. And I was wondering how you feel about that criticism in terms of the underrepresentation of the culturalist dimension in your account. Do you think that's a fair criticism? Do you think that's probably just a misinterpretation of your works in that sense?
Well, I think I'm not sure. Let me put it this way. So there are two very different sorts of things that people mean by culture. Yeah. And there are two very different sorts of things that people mean by institutions. So if you talk to some anthropologists, everything is culture,
yeah,
including lots of things that we would call institutions.
Mm.
And there is a narrow sense in which institutions can be conceived, and that would be just the constitution and some formal laws. So we certainly, from the beginning of Why Nations Fail, declare that we want to go with the broader definition of institutions,
yeah,
encompassing all of the informal aspects. So, and then in line with that, we defined culture, or the alternative to the institutions, as cultural theories that emphasize very long-lasting national, religious, or racial aspects of culture. So the French culture versus the British culture, Protestant culture versus the Catholic culture, the Muslim culture, and so on.
Yeah.
And that is not uncontroversial, but we felt that given the ascendancy of some of these national cultural ideas, again in social science over the last, you know, several decades, that was a useful distinction, and we were sure, and we had some of the, you know, informal and some of the formal evidence that those dimensions of culture don't matter.
Okay.
Now, what that really left out, meaning that it wasn't kind of in great detail treated, were norms.
Yeah.
And clearly, when you think of a certain set of norms, such as, you know, do we obey laws? Do we trust institutions? How do we solve collective action problems? Do we pour into the streets when, you know, our rights are violated, or do we just take it on the chin? Those are really intimately linked with the institutional aspects of society, and that's the way that we wanted to treat them, and we touched upon them in Why Nations Fail. But that's one of the things that we wanted to redress in some sense in the narrow corridor, and yeah, that's why there is a somewhat more detailed discussion of norms and how norms and institutions interplay. And that's still sort of work in progress. And we're by no means the only ones thinking about these issues.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting, because on the issue of norms, I've always pondered where not. It's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, right? In that some stories would have that institutions cultivate norms, and others would say that norms are the sort of main proponents of institutions, and you end up with a case.
Absolutely.
Where it's probably,
and I think they're both true. They're both absolutely,
yeah,
true.
I suppose the question then is, do you think there's a meaningful difference between cases like, let's call them type one cases, where it's institutions engendering and creating norms, so it's an institution-led sort of development of culture, versus a sort of more bottom-up, organically evolved, norm-propelled institutional development? Do you think, like, per empirical or theoretical analysis, there's a meaningful difference in how this impacts, say, development or other political or economic outcomes in that sense? Or do you think these are merely...
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
The way that we have conceptualized that in the book, and that's where, you know, that gets to the heart of our discussion of the cage of norms in the narrow,
yeah,
corridor. And it's, you know, it's not comprehensive, I'm sure, but the way that we think about it is that you do definitely need institutional change to impact, to start relaxing and changing certain norm-based restrictions.
Yeah.
That doesn't deny that there are dynamics in the norms themselves, but those are extremely slow, haphazard, and generally not very powerful. So the way that I would say, the way that we try to sort of formalize this, and we're trying to write a new paper, sort of digging a little bit deeper into these issues now, is that you need the laws and institutions to start saying, no, certain traditionally conceived norms cannot be operated in the way that they have operated so far, or some of the responsibilities that are vested in, say, conflict resolution and dispute resolution into decentralized communities have to be transferred to a higher authority. But if you do that without at the same time being consistent and without at the same time getting some support from existing norms, the likelihood of backlash is very strong. So therefore, it's a very delicate dance that you need to get the affirmation of existing norms, but at the same time find a way of changing the norms. And that's our interpretation. For example, if you look at several chapters, these issues are discussed, but perhaps most saliently in chapter 6 in the European case. You know, when you look at, you know, Clovis's Salic law, and the same is true of King Alfred's law code, you know, what's remarkable is that at some level, they are very radical departures from the way that laws were imposed. But on the other hand, they spend a large chunk of their time, both in effect and in symbolism, in saying, look, we are just part of what used to be done. We're just codifying what was done. And in fact, you know, we didn't really write, you know, in the Clovis's case, I didn't really write these laws. These were given to me by lawgivers, and I am charged by implementing them. So that's all part of this effort to make it appear as this is consistent with the norms. And in fact, it is in many ways. You know, that's why they spend so much time about the blood feud. You know, Clovis's attempt and his followers' attempts to sort of regulate society, of course, wasn't consistent with the uninterrupted operation of blood feud, but they couldn't completely turn their back on that.
And I actually want to just follow up specifically on the narrow corridor, because you mentioned the sort of the dangers or the tendency towards the two extremities, where on one hand you have the despotic Leviathan, and the other hand you have the absent Leviathan, where cages of norms sort of step in and come into play here. I guess I just have two sub-questions about that. The first question is, hypothetically at least, and if not empirically, that I could perhaps envision a case where you neither have a very strong set of cage of norms nor a very strong sort of oppressive Leviathan, and yet you would still have some degree of flourishing society. So we're envisioning, for example, very civil libertarian small government and small society or small collectivism state, where individuals largely lead their lives according to own volitions, neither influenced by strong norms nor strong laws. And I was wondering if you'd perhaps be able to say more about this, at least theoretical possibility, if not perhaps arguably empirically.
I don't know, Brian. Perhaps it is possible, but you know, if you look at many examples of those, I think you will find very restrictive norms. I think one example is the kibbutzim in Israel. You know, you can say that's like an egalitarian norm-based society with lots of, you know, democratic, you know, flourishings. But again, kibbutzim has such strict norms. There are a lot of restrictions on what individuals can do. And, you know, how are they enforced? There's a huge amount of ostracism, gossip, you know, reputation that's at stake in the operation of the kibbutzim. So I think, you know, and the same is true, you know, like, you know, many of the early republics, like the Roman Republic, had a very norm-based operation.
And I guess the question, I was thinking more
even along, though in those cases, they also had, you know, flourishings of early states.
Yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of, say, the Levellers' Agreement in British political history, or perhaps the attempt.
Well, I think the Levellers are hugely interesting, but of course they didn't really set up a society.
Right. Yeah.
So I think if they come to set up a society, it would have had to sort of come to that particular fork in the road and decide either to centralize power more than they had promised, or develop other norms, or really put up with a lot more instability than would have been desirable.
Yeah.
But again, we don't know in that case.
I think that's fair. I guess my question there perhaps is, maybe there's a possibility for an organic evolution of strong norms and nevertheless like maximally Nozickian libertarian, and that sort of enforces, ironically, precisely because of how strong that norm of, I suppose, libertarianism is, you therefore end up with a state, or at least a society, where you have egalitarianism without an enforcement mechanism. Perhaps that's something that is possible
perhaps,
in the future.
It's hard for me to envisage that, but yeah.
And the second sub-question I have is, when you were talking about the cages of norms, I was quite piqued by your usage of cages, because to me, the way I see it is, I think they are, it's fair to say a vast majority of societies either have strong states, or successful societies to some extent either have strong states that are shackled, or to some degree strong norms, and you can have both coexisting concurrently. But I was wondering if there was an attempt to operationalize the different types of norms we're talking about, like, say, some society might have cages of norms that perpetuate hierarchies, whereas some others might be sort of norms that enforce, I suppose, hierarchies without the inegalitarianism associated with it. So looking at Japan, for instance, with a Confucian structure, and nevertheless a relatively egalitarian society, whereas in China you also have the Confucian culture, but it's a far more sort of rarefied and polarized society in terms of wealth inequalities. And I was just thinking, it's interesting to see the language of cages being used, but would there be an attempt to further fine-grain the theory of how norms affect...
So I think you're asking some good questions. My answer is, again, I don't know. I think every society that I have seen operating without a state has its own social hierarchies. I certainly wouldn't say the Japanese is fairly egalitarian. You know, before the Meiji Restoration, I think there is a very, very strong sense of hierarchy in that society. And after the Meiji Restoration, it changes somehow, but it's, you know, again, remains highly inegalitarian in many respects.
Yeah.
But you're right, the extent of those social hierarchies do vary across situations. But I think I'm not sure whether we are at a situation to provide a complete typology of all of these things. I mean, there are some interesting regularities. Mm. Almost all the ones that we know, with a few matrimonial ones which are very poorly understood, put women at the bottom. So there is a male over female hierarchy.
Yeah.
But it seems like, you know, any type of force, you know, physical force, violence, you know, increases those social hierarchies.
Yeah.
But there may yet be others. The important one is that many societies are quite successful in preventing hereditary class-based hierarchies and institutionalized hierarchies. Mm.
And just to sort of shift or apply the typology there perhaps to the context of China, because I've read sort of both Why Nations Fail and Narrow Corridors, and I think your diagnosis of China is something I broadly agree with. I was wondering if you've read Huang Yasheng's read or take on China's grassroots entrepreneurship in the 1980s, actually. And
Yes, absolutely. I think we cite that in Why Nations Fail. I'm not sure, but yes, I like Yasheng's analysis.
Yeah,
I think I agree very much with the 90s, his analysis of 1980s, and I actually also agree with his analysis of the transition.
Yeah,
I never understood from his account, and I've asked him this, and I didn't get a clear answer either, is you know, how he explains the very rapid development in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And I think that is the harder part for his classification to come to grips with.
And would you say, what would be your sort of main story now in 2019, since you wrote Why Nations Fail? Would you say you've changed your sort of story with regards to what happened in the late 90s for China?
Well, I don't think I have changed any of my analysis of my and Jim's analysis of what happened in the 70s, 80s, which in the 80s agrees very much with Yasheng, 90s, 2000s. What I would say is that there are two wild cards, which, you know, we did not foresee in 2010 when we completed Why Nations Fail. And I don't know what they imply, honestly. One wild card is artificial intelligence. One view, which, you know, is not my view, but it's not to be dismissed lightly, is that because China is going to have access to so much data and is also so keen on using artificial intelligence, not just for, you know, production, but sort of for surveillance and organization of society, it is going to surge ahead in artificial intelligence, even if it has a natural disadvantage in innovation. And perhaps that economies of scale in data is going to undo the classic disadvantage of extractive political institutions in fostering innovation. I don't think so. I don't think so for two reasons. One is that I think the increasing returns, economies of scale in data are somewhat exaggerated. They are present, but they run out after a while. So especially moving forward, new artificial intelligence will not need billions of observations, will be more scalable from lower down. But again, that remains to be seen. And also, as we also again revisit in the narrow corridor, the disadvantage of planned top-down state-controlled systems in innovation, especially in fostering experimentation and diversity of different approaches, is quite real and is a disadvantage. So though I think the jury is still out, and this might be a factor that delays China's sort of stagnation technologically, my belief is still with the broader predictions that we made in Why Nations Fail. The second factor is much more of a wilder card, and that's the collapse of the US, UK, and the European sort of leadership. So, you know, the presumption in Why Nations Fail was that the alternative to China would keep chugging along. But if that collapses, or if that potential problems, perhaps in conjunction with the interaction with China, economically, politically, socially, but most likely because of its own internal dynamics, then of course, you know, we are in a very different chapter of world history. And I don't think that's completely out of question.
I actually have a quick, just very quick comment before a sort of follow-up question, because when it comes to mechanization and automation, I guess the worry there is that a lot of the more sort of the value of the inclusionary and extractive institutions juxtaposition might be the how human capital and also innovation often interact with these institutions. But I guess if you have a regime that operates on a basis of effectively the ability of machines to recreate the intellectual aspects or the innovative aspects of humans to the extent that actually comes into play, it seems that then the human capital story, which is crucially underpinning, I think, a lot of the, not all of, but a lot of the inclusive extractive institution cut, might actually be superseded in that sense.
Absolutely. You are 100% right. And I should have added that. And I should have said that not only I am skeptical that there are huge economies of return, economies of scale in AI, but I'm also very skeptical that at least in the next, during my lifetime and probably beyond, that machines are going to have anything approaching creativity.
That's very
so. If you look at current AI trends, which I also study, you know, there are huge successes, but they are the narrowest of the narrow.
Yeah,
they are not in the same mold as, you know, the aspirations of cybernetics people, you know, the original you know, prophets of AI, where you replicate human thinking. They are able to start from a training data set, however unstructured it is, and replicate and predict certain behavior according to some well-specified rules or according to rules that they glean from observed data, but they are not capable of generalizing across domains or engage in truly flexible creative thinking.
And I agree with you with the thoughts on strong AI, actually, but I was just wondering in terms of the West, because it's interesting you mentioned that, because I feel that a lot of the West, at least over up until say 2008 and perhaps 2012, have largely had broadly, somewhat, at least politically, sort of functioning and broadly inclusive institutions, even though there are, of course, wealth inequalities that prohibit political access and participation to some extent, of course. But then we've seen since sort of the early 2010s, a rising on encroachment of, I would say, cultural authoritarianism, sort of rise of Trump in the US, and then some of the xenophobia underpinning certain wings, not all of, but certain branches of the Brexit movement, and then of course the Five Star Party, Viktor Orban in Hungary. I was wondering if there's a way for your sort of politico-economic framework to capture this, and if you'd like to take that framework further, what would be the direction in response to these phenomena?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, again, this is not something that we foresaw in Why Nations Fail.
Yeah.
We did, of course, observe and see and talk about the rise in inequality, but we hadn't understood how deeply scarred people's aspirations and trust in institutions had become.
Yeah.
And this is what we try to talk about in chapter 13 of The Narrow Corridor.
Yeah.
And I would really highlight two critical issues, which, in my opinion, undergird the current problems. One is this sense of distrust in institutions.
Yeah.
I think last 30 years, people being left out have come to view that institutions are not working for them, they're not protecting them, they're not doing what they're supposed to do. Hence, and here I think the financial crisis and its aftermath and the bailouts of the bankers and all have really greatly contributed to this. They are there to protect the already privileged. And I think that view is really quite widespread in the US, in the UK, in parts of Italy. You know, if you are viewed, if you went, I mean, the Five Star Movement now is in descendants, in decline, and I don't think they are the most xenophobic, the most dangerous part of the movements in Italy, but so be it. If you go and talk to Five Star politicians or some of the supporters, you know, and talk about, say, experts that allied themselves, say, with the Socialist Party or the bureaucracy, they will tell you, well, they're in it, they're in the conspiracy. They are part of the problem, they're just defending the system.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it has come to that in Italy, for example, after 25 years of no growth, despite the fact that some people really became fabulously wealthy.
Yeah.
In the US, you have over 30 years of more than half of the population not benefiting from economic growth, again, while, you know, huge numbers of people became fabulously wealthy.
Yeah.
So these processes really led to this erosion of trust.
Mm.
But also, hard times, I think, this is something I'm trying to research right now, it's not in any of our books, but I think hard times, you know, times of uncertainty and economic hardship make people more uncompromising, less charitable, especially towards outgroups.
Yeah.
And I think these two currents together are relevant for understanding why we have become much more nationalistic. So, you know, there is a lot, all this discussion of populism, right-wing populism. That's absolutely right. I think that's a real trend. But one trend that we don't seem to emphasize enough is that, you know, as much as the other legs of the populist agenda, it's the nationalist leg that's motivating. Look at Modi.
Yeah.
Where does Narendra Modi's support come from? It comes from Indian nationalism. Mm. Why do people still support Duterte, or in Turkey, Erdogan? Because he's able to cultivate this sense of nationalism, which we thought was in decline in the 2000s.
Yeah.
But, you know, during the time of economic hardship, it has come back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just to sort of, we're closing, sort of rounding off our discussion with the final sort of two quick questions, actually. Because I do want to pick your brains about the elephant in the room when it comes to the US in 2020. Because in 2016, you mentioned that Democrats need to find and forge an important coalition that can cater to those who are, in many ways, vulnerable and downtrodden. And I was wondering, what does this look like in 2020? And what are your thoughts on who would perhaps best be able to channel that amongst the Democrats, if anyone at all, in bringing hope back to the system?
You know, I mean, it's hard to know. I am very, very convinced that whoever is going to be that standard bearer has to appeal to the middle ground.
Yeah.
Because the danger is, and there is a lot of evidence, when it's an ideological discourse, the middle of the road Democratic supporters don't turn out, and some of them turn to Republicans, and the Republican turnout increases. So I am very worried about people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah.
She is a rabble rouser and, you know, polarizes. You know, she's a very successful user of social media, but I think her sort of effect is more to energize the other side. On the Democratic side, look, I think Elizabeth Warren has a lot of centrist instincts, but she has gone more in certain directions. You know, some of the things she has done, I agree with. But I do worry about, unless she really repackages her agenda, that she would have that scary effect on some of the middle ground. So I think she's a viable candidate, but she really needs to reorient herself and her rhetoric, and especially for the middle class, working class male voters, she has no appeal right now. Pete Buttigieg, I think, has some appeal, but, you know, I don't know. Look, I think whoever ends up in that process, we have to rally around them, because Trump is really dangerous, and a second term would be worse than the first term, I fear.
Absolutely. And I guess the sort of the final question, and slightly unrelated, is or perhaps related, actually, is I've always been mesmerized by your ability and Jim's ability to sort of compress such complex ideas and distill them in simple language and vivid examples that basically convince a lot of generalized readers of the arguments you're making. And what's the trick to that? And do you think that's sort of a key part of what you've been trying to carry out in your public
facing? That's absolutely what we've been trying to do. And I think it's a belief, it's a twofold belief that, you know, one, these ideas are important and they need to be communicated. And two, is a belief that both Jim and I share in the necessity to simplify. Look, history is complex. There is no way that if you want to be faithful to the details of any particular case, that you can reach any simple message from it. But there is a simple message sometimes, oftentimes, underneath those details. And it is a effort that the writer has to put in order to distill that. And it involves putting your neck on the line, because there will be historians that say, no, you've ignored this detail or that detail. But I think the unity of these simple mechanisms across different cases is quite powerful when you actually start revealing it.
Yeah. And would you have sort of any advice to public-facing economists and academics in that sense, who want to sort of hopefully follow your footsteps and emulate your successes in that.
Well, I don't know about our successes. I'm sure that your generation will be even more successful, or much more successful. But you know, I have a firm belief here. Perhaps it's a little bit self-interested, but I really believe that to be a good positive influence on the public debate without selling your soul in the Faustian bargain, you really need to keep one leg in firm research.
Yeah.
I think when people just jump into the public arena and want to be a public intellectual,
yes,
but without actually doing the academic work on the side,
yeah,
they become unrooted from the research, but also they become less rigorous in their willingness to question their own ideas. Look, we take a lot of chances with our hypothesis, especially when we apply them to new domains, but we continuously try to question them. And that questioning, I feel, is really important. And the process of research is really important. That's where the new ideas should come from. They shouldn't come from the pages of the New York Times or the Economist.
Absolutely.
I have nothing against these publications. Well, sometimes I do, but that's not where new ideas should come from. The new ideas should come from, you know, rigorous research.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so, so much.
Well, let me add one final thing, since you're in Hong Kong, that I really give my best wishes to all of the people in Hong Kong, who I think are engaged in an epic struggle. And I think it's so gratifying to see young people so engaged and so inspiringly certain in their future, in their values for the future.
Thank you very much for your words, Professor. Much appreciated. Well, thanks for your time. And
have a good day. Have a good day, Brian. I hope our paths cross in the near future.
Yes, I hope so too. Hope to see you soon. Take care. Merry Christmas. And a Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas to you. Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Bye.